Hey, everyone. Welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Paris Schutz. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at.
Do we have the political will to spend the money now and prevent future generations from these terrible outcomes?
A Chicago mother seeks to raise awareness of Chicago's widespread lead paint problem after her son was poisoned in their home. The three-year anniversary of the state's COVID lockdown, a look at lessons learned and what's to come with the city's top doc. It could be Mayor Lightfoot's final defeat, why a major deal she brokered with ComEd is flaming out.
What time is it?
It's time to build the airport.
And is it finally time for a South Suburban airport? Now to our top story tonight. It's the hidden health hazard in most Chicago homes. Lead in paint has been outlawed in Chicago since 1978. But a WTTW investigation has found the vast majority of Chicago's housing stock still contains potentially toxic levels, and that most children are not being tested regularly. Environmental advocates say the health risk could be eliminated if the city proactively inspected for lead instead of waiting for a resident to report elevated levels in their blood. One Chicago mother hopes her toddler's tragic story provides a wake-up call.
Like any two-year-old, Jedi Ruziska is an active and spirited child. But his mother, Elena Long, says he is in therapy every day for physical, behavioral, and cognitive health problems. She says she noticed something wrong in October at his 18-month checkup.
He wasn't talking, he wasn't making any eye contact, and I did notice that he was, like, eating things that were not food.
The doctor sent Jedi to the emergency room for lead poisoning. The CDC considers any level above 5 micrograms per deciliter of blood to be dangerous. Jedi's level was 76.
It's really scary because I didn't know where this was coming from. Where was he poisoned? And then we found out he was poisoned in our own home.
The most likely source of lead poisoning for children here in Chicago is lead-based paint.
Candace Robinson is the Chicago Department of Public Health's medical director for maternal, infant, child, and adolescent health. She says a lead poisoning report automatically triggers a CDPH investigation. Inspectors went to the family's Belmont Cragen apartment and found hazards in hallways and stairways, as well as in rotting windowsills in the family's bedrooms. Jedi had been exposed for a year, inhaling dust and eating paint chips. Inspectors said Jedi could return home safely once those areas were cleaned, but Elena says the family decided to move out instead. Per federal law, landlords must notify their tenants about known lead paint risks before they move in. We reached out to the landlord by phone. He admitted he failed to do so, saying he didn't know there were any risks. He also acknowledged the lead had not yet been abated. Robinson admits the cleanup can take months.
Our inspectors typically follow up with the owners on a monthly basis to ensure that that is happening and that they are following up and making those repairs to that property.
According to medical records, doctors diagnosed Jedi with a series of health problems: mixed expressive language disorder, autism spectrum disorder, and moderate cognitive impairment.
How many of these issues typically can be tied to lead poisoning?
All of them. Lead is a neurotoxin. It crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Ann Evans is the CEO of Elevate, a nonprofit that advocates for healthy and affordable homes and has also advocated for proactive inspection of lead-based paint.
It's been really well documented that lead damages a child's developing brain that results in these cognitive impairments, learning disabilities, and behavioral problems.
According to CDPH data, the number of children with elevated lead levels in 2021 was less than 2%. That's down from 70% in 1996. But CDPH admits less than 50% of children are being tested regularly. And data finds that in many low-income and communities of color, between 30 and 40% of all residents in older homes tested positive.
And so in those older homes, what we often find is sometimes that paint is starting to deteriorate and starting to break down.
When asked how many pre-1978 units contain lead paint risks, a spokesperson responded, quote, CDPH finds lead hazards in about 99% of residences built before 1978.
Wouldn't it be a safer system if the city just regularly inspected all of these units, regardless of what was being reported?
Again, I can only speak to the system we have in place now. I can't forecast other systems that could be in place.
A proposed city ordinance called the Chicago Healthy Homes Checkup Pilot would require periodic inspection for all pre-1978 units. Advocates acknowledge it would cost billions at a time where the city might have to spend between $10 and $15 billion to replace lead water service lines.
Do we have the political will to spend the money now and prevent future generations from these terrible outcomes?
It really hurts because, you know, he should be able to do what other kids are doing, and he hasn't been doing them yet.
And Long says JEDI is still testing positive for elevated lead levels, about 17 micrograms per deciliter. CDPH says there is federal money that can assist owners in abating their lead paint problem. The family has set up a GoFundMe, meanwhile, to help with their son's medical expenses. And you can find more information on that on our website. And we are now joined by the director of CDPH, Dr. Allison Arwadi. Thank you for coming back. And it's the anniversary of COVID, three-year anniversary, so we want to talk to you about that. But we just saw this story. Given what we just saw, is it time for the city to institute a system where they proactively inspect these units and abate the problem, even though it might cost a lot of money?
Yeah, so a couple things. First, I'm really glad that you're covering this because a lot of the conversation has been about the lead service lines, the water, the pipes. But as you heard, it is lead paint that is poisoning children in Chicago today. CDPH, even before COVID, had put together a predictive model where we can predict, based on the age of a home or based on similar findings around it, homes where a child may be at higher risk for lead poisoning. We'd like to be doing more in those spaces. It costs money, for sure. Last year was the first time that the city put significant resources through a bond, $47 million to help augment some of the fixing of some of these places for people who may not qualify for the federal grants. But there's a lot of work to do here, and it is a big problem. We've made major progress, but we've made that progress with a focus on paint, and we've got to keep it.
So clearly, the city knows the most at-risk units. It could be in the hundreds of thousands. Should City Council pass the Healthy Homes Ordinance, would that go a long way to helping this?
I think it's certainly something, you know, proactive work is always going to be something the health department is interested in. My biggest interest is making sure that proactive inspections that we're doing start in those highest risk places, that we're really getting in and expanding our ability to do more there. We have the ability to do some of that modeling. We've already done it, but it's about resources and it's about commitment.
How much money do you think it's going to take? Clearly, you don't have anywhere near the amount of money to do that right now.
Yeah, part of it's money and part of it, I think, is inspectors. Where we've looked at the proposal that City Council is considering at the moment, you know, we really do think, as projected, it would take something like 600 inspectors. And there are, that's more people than work at the entire Chicago Department of Public Health right now. So the scale here is really substantial. I do think it's something that we should be taking real steps on, where we know there are problem buildings from the buildings department, where we know that there are homes with have the potential for higher level of lead. You know, there's agreement about that we could be doing more on this, and I think we're anxious to keep having those conversations and make some real progress
in
this space.
Maybe something for the next mayor to keep in mind and the next city council, a very urgent issue, given that they're spending billions of dollars over the next several years on lead pipes. You're saying this is the bigger danger right now for children, the lead paint. Let's move on to COVID, the other reason that you're here. 3 years ago, almost to the day, the NBA cancels its season. In the state locks businesses down and schools down, travel from Europe is banned. When did you realize this was going to be a health crisis unlike any other?
Oh, goodness. I think, you know, looking back, we'd been following COVID for some time. We'd had some cases here. But really, in early March, when it all started, that's really when it all started for everybody. We went from a week when we were testing samples at emergency departments across the city and found zero COVID to the next week, 40% of the samples being positive. It was really a remarkably fast just explosion of cases in the community setting.
And did that alarm you as to where this might be headed?
Oh, yes.
And overwhelmed hospitals and doctor's offices?
Yeah, I think, you know, we were in some ways lucky to be able to see what had happened in Italy and then to an extent New York, if you look back. Really watching Italy was what alarmed me, because Italy is a country that has a lot of resources for healthcare, that has a good public health system. And we watched that country very quickly get overwhelmed. If it can happen in Italy, you know it's going to happen here. There's the potential. And so I think some of the decisions here, those difficult decisions around shutdowns and major changes, were coming out of looking at what had happened in some other settings. And I think one reason, I mean, COVID hit so hard here as it did everywhere, but compared to what we saw in New York, compared to what we saw in Italy, some of those hard decisions early on, I think were the important ones to be making.
And there is a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking by a lot of people about some of those decisions. So in hindsight, shutting down schools, businesses, mandatory masking, did those things work? Were those the right decisions?
Yeah, so I want to be super clear that always you're making your decisions based on the information that you have at that time. And I think especially at the beginning, when we knew next to nothing about how COVID spread, we assumed that it spread like other coronaviruses and that, you know, you couldn't spread it until you had symptoms. There was a lot we didn't know about the science, but it was very clear that it was overwhelming health systems and killing people. And you absolutely have to act decisively at the beginning there. I think the schools conversation is one that once we had data and we knew that in fact it was appropriate for children to be in school with all of the good mitigation measures, as you know, that was something that we pushed pretty hard to come back around on the next school year. But it's about making decisions with the best information that you have at the time. And I really, you know, I want Chicago to know that that is absolutely what we did at every point, and there's not a thing I would change.
And I think that was one of the first shutdowns, one of the first outbreaks happened in a school, and I remember it shutting down right away. COVID is still with us, obviously. We hear of people every single day having COVID, perhaps for the second or third time. What would you assess the stage that we're in?
Yeah, so we're at a low COVID level, meaning that we always, as a country now, every county, are we at a low level, a medium level, or a high level? What does that mean? It means there's people still getting COVID. It means we're not seeing a high number of hospitalizations. We're not seeing that hospital overwhelm. We're not seeing high numbers of deaths. And that means that you don't need to have those much stronger measures in place. But it also means that we, you know, I think of it sort of like the flu in some ways. It is still more dangerous than the flu, just to be really clear on that. It's still hospitalizing 20 to 30 Chicagoans every day and killing almost one Chicagoan a day. But it is something that I expect to probably see some seasonal pattern in. We have tools that we didn't have, right? The big one in year two was the vaccine. The big one in year three were early treatments. And with vaccine and early treatments, we do have the ability to contain this in a way that we just didn't at the beginning.
Would you recommend yearly vaccine boosters like we do with the flu shot?
Yeah, I think we're going to see what happens, but my guess is that yes. My guess is most likely every fall, in the same way we do a booster based on the strains of flu that are circulating that year, my guess is that's where we're going to be going for COVID too. And so most likely every fall, you'll get your COVID and your flu shot to help best protect you heading through the winter. We'll see, and COVID could always throw us a curveball, but assuming we don't see a major change in the virus itself, a new, really scary, bad variant, we have a high level of some immunity now to these variants.
We are out of time, but I want to ask you, you're going to have a new chief executive come May. Do you want to stay on in this post to whoever's mayor?
Yes, that is absolutely my goal. I love my job. I love my team. And I am first and foremost a public health enthusiast. And so I'm hoping to stay on. Yes.
Absolutely. And we've been very thankful over the years for you to come on here and give us the raw facts over the last 3 years of COVID. Dr. Allison Arwadi, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And up next, some more of today's top stories, so please stay with us.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Now some more of tonight's top stories. Illinois is one step closer to having a new top federal prosecutor. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth sent President Biden two recommendations to replace John Lausch as U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. They are Sergio Acosta and April Perry, who both spent more than a dozen years as leaders in the U.S. Attorney's Office. It's the first time either a person of color or a woman would serve as the chief prosecutor in the state. Whoever the president picks will be reviewed and voted on by the Senate Judiciary Committee, which Senator Dick Durbin chairs. The nomination then goes to the full Senate for a vote. In the meantime, Morris Pasquale will continue to serve as acting U.S. attorney. Here we go again. Your commute on the Kennedy Expressway is going to take a lot longer as a massive three-year project kicks off tonight. Drivers heading south into the city will find the two left lanes of the Kennedy closed from Montrose to Hubbard's Cave. But outbound traffic's affected too because the reversible express lanes will only be open to inbound traffic. The road work will shift to the Kennedy's two right lanes in July. The Illinois Department of Transportation encourages drivers to find another route downtown or to use public transportation. Voters are back at the polls. Early voting kicked off today for 14 city council seats and, of course, the mayoral runoff between Brandon Johnson and Paul Vallis. Chicagoans can cast their votes at early voting sites that are open in each of Chicago's 50 wards or at the two Chicago Board of Elections sites in the Loop. Votes can also be cast by mail. Meanwhile, election officials are pleading for more poll workers on Election Day, which is April 4th. Don't forget to visit the WTTW News Chicago Runoff Election Voter Guide for more information on the candidates. You can search by name, race, or ward and find out where candidates stand on the issues in their own words. You'll find that guide on our website, WTTW.com/news. Up next, the likelihood City Council passes the mayor's proposed ComEd deal. Heather Sharon with that story right after this. Chances are fading that City Council will pass a proposed deal to extend ComEd's lucrative contract with the city. WTTW News reporter Heather Sharon joins us now for a look at what is likely to be Mayor Lori Lightfoot's final City Council defeat. Heather, remind us what this deal included.
Well, it was a 15-year deal that included $100 million to help the city fight climate change. It also included an agreement to build a West Side training facility that was going to cost $32.5 million to train 10,000 Chicagoans to work in the green energy sector, as well as to train another 1,000 South and West Side residents to work for the company.
So these are all things that are part of the franchise agreement, which,
right,
for our viewers, gives ComEd the exclusive right to provide power to Chicago homes and businesses. So why was it immediately blocked from advancing?
Well, Lightfoot unveiled this deal just about a month before Election Day, which meant that all 50 members of the City Council were preoccupied with their reelection and perhaps unwilling to take such a significant vote so close to Election Day. There's also no doubt that her enemies on the City Council were looking for a way to hurt her before she sought a second term.
Perhaps they were more emboldened at that point. Heather, I think we remember about a month ago, the mayor was really touting this. Her chief of policy, Skylar Larimore, was right here on Chicago Tonight saying that City Council should pass this.
$100 million to go to neighborhood climate equity projects. What does that actually mean? That's shareholder dollars, company profits, that no other municipality around the country has been able to secure at that scale.
Didn't change any minds. How come?
Well, there were real questions about who was going to have the authority to spend that $100 million. The way the deal envisioned it was going to create a new nonprofit with board seats appointed by ComEd and the city. That wasn't clear how that would work. Also, we've been covering for the last 2 weeks the trial of four ComEd-affiliated former employees, and there was a great deal of consternation that something was going to come out during this trial that would have embarrassed anyone who voted for it.
All right, Heather, so this is the million-dollar, or I should say billion-dollar question. Paul Vallis, Brandon Johnson, what is their plan for a new franchise agreement with ComEd?
Well, they don't like Lori Lightfoot's plan, but for one of them, whoever takes office on May 22nd, this is going to be at the top of his to-do list because this agreement that the city's been operating under expired in December 2020.
All right. Just one of many things on the to-do list for the next mayor. Heather Sharone, thanks very much.
Thanks, Ferris.
And read Heather's full story on our website, WTTW.com/news. After years of delays, could it finally be time for a South Suburban airport to take off? Lawmakers from the southern suburbs are advancing a plan in Springfield that would get the ball rolling on an airport in Will County. Amanda Vinicky joins us now with the latest in this ever-long saga. The Lincoln Airport, the Obama Airport, the Piatone Airport, it's had different names and proposals. Is it finally happening?
Well, Paris, you've heard the saying, if at first you don't succeed, try again. Local officials in the south suburbs seem to be embracing that maxim. Despite literally decades of trying, and despite the state spending almost $100 million to buy land that could host an airport, none of these planes are flying out of Will County. That hasn't stopped supporters from giving up.
I'm wearing a lapel pin that says Airport 2000. This was an initiative 30 years ago. We've waited long enough. It's time to build a South Suburban airport.
Even if there was broad agreement, the project isn't ready to launch. Illinois spent that $97 million to buy about 90% of the land needed, but would still have to procure that final 10%, a hurdle Governor J.B. Pritzker recently said would have to happen in order for him to get fully on board. Pritzker also says he wants to make sure cargo carriers would use it.
What you don't want is if you build it, they will come, right? Just building the thing and hoping that people will show up to essentially pay for the airport having been built. You need to make sure that you're building it because you have interest.
An effort that's gaining support in Springfield would force the Pritzker administration to move things along. The proposed law would require the state's transportation department to inch open the door to developers.
Developers who are interested in building the airport to put pen to paper so they can show their capacity, their desire, their willingness, and their money to be able to build our third airport here today.
Chicago, of course, already has O'Hare and Midway, Amanda. Some might say that's not good enough. So how would this airport be different?
Well, Paris, for a stretch, the plan was to make Piatone an alternate passenger airport to serve those that are living in the growing south suburbs, but not anymore. Plans now call for it to be cargo-focused.
This will be a different kind of airport, built to serve industry, built to serve cargo carriers, built for e-commerce and logistics and our modern economies.
Supporters point out Will County hosts the nation's largest inland port. The state is investing in highways to accommodate truck traffic near there. And then Amazon and other companies are building huge fulfillment centers nearby. Backers like unions, a coalition of mayors, and the local chamber say an airport is a natural fit and one that would create some 10,000 construction jobs plus an estimated 50,000 permanent ones.
The new companies will pay property taxes to fund our local schools, municipalities, and services, much like O'Hara does in the northwest suburbs. Additionally, this airport will help reshoring jobs back to America and retain jobs in Illinois.
But critics say even if Illinois pursues the additional airport, the state will find no need for it.
It was first proposed as a solution to the fact that we couldn't expand O'Hare Airport. Well, then we expanded O'Hare Airport. Then they decided we needed a new passenger facility for the south suburbs, but the airlines showed zero interest in it. So now it's purportedly a solution to our air cargo problems. But we don't have air cargo problems. We have O'Hare, we have Rockford, we have Gary.
He also says it doesn't make sense to expand water, roads, electricity, and all the things needed to create a commercial center in what he calls the middle of nowhere. I did speak with a leader of the Will County Board who is opposed to it. This is currently agricultural land, and her farm is smack in the middle of the property that would become that airport there. And that Will County board member says that this whole idea would be, is really, has been a waste of taxpayer money, and it is rooted solely in politics. And that Paris, of course, is a contention that supporters of this dispute, they say that this is really rooted in empowering local people.
But opponents clearly saying it's a solution, perhaps, in search of a problem, Amanda. We'll see if this debate gets anywhere in the next coming years. It's been going on forever.
For all right. 30 years, yeah.
Thanks so much. And up next, we lay out what's on tap for tomorrow. That's it for this Monday night. Please join us tomorrow night live at 10. Is Donald Trump getting arrested this week? A look at the accusations facing the former president. And it's a life-changing moment for hundreds of medical students. We give you a look into Match Day. And on the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, we leave you tonight with a look at portraits of some brave men and women who lost their lives in battle. The Portrait of a Soldier exhibit is on display at the Cook County Building through March 25th. And now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a wonderful evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that's proud to serve its community through pro bono legal services.